Week with the documentary produced in Abbotsford, British Columbia, we'll be meeting with the musician Shamir Virgo, a singer-songwriter from Surrey, BC, who's enjoying some success. His song, Roses, has more than 1.7 million listens on Spotify and SoundCloud.
One of the first songs that he showed me that he wrote was a song called Roses. The first line, just a killer line, it goes, heartache covered in roses. You know, like, what a way to start a song. And then boom, you're hooked, you're drawn right in.
Mike McCullough, who will spend this half hour with Virgo, as well as with some of his friends and mentors.
The first day we met, we ended up just writing Roses.
Yeah, we kind of like built off of it.
I don't know, it just came out naturally.
And then we're writing the song back and forth, had it on a loop.
When it came time to write the chords for Roses, and I was like, you know what? Let's apply some of the jazz harmony that we're learning. You know, after a few more writing sessions, we had a finished song between the two of us, and it came up fairly easily.
Yeah. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I got sick of the sorrow, but I want to see you tomorrow.
With Shamir, we kind of go back and forth with this song since the last show even.
Yeah.
And it's been one of those fun spots for us.
For sure. Yeah.
But it's fun. I enjoy it. But keeps me going.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Greetings, nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassaigne. Shamir Virgo is a 23-year-old rhythm and blues recording artist and songwriter from Surrey, BC, who, when he's not attending class at the University of the Fraser Valley, has recently been wowing crowds and gaining a fan base performing around the Lower Mainland. Virgo is enjoying some early success with The Algorithm, one of his first songs, a track called Roses, which he wrote with friend Amir Kuro, has more than 1.7 million listens on Spotify and SoundCloud. In this brief look at one of Canada's exciting new artists, Mike McCullough in Abbotsford caught up with Shamir and some of Shamir's friends, collaborators, and one-time mentor. Here's Mike McCullough.
This is Shamir Virgo.
Heartache covered in roses. I'm done trying to control it. I'm waiting for you to see.
I genuinely just really love, I have a really great big love for music.
But I'd rather be with you than in my dreams.
Very blessed. Very blessed to be here right now and to be able to express and share my art in the way that I do. Yeah. Thank you.
His likability was infectious. Everybody loved him. We could keep
it real. He is so thoughtful and he is so sweet. When I can see your smile, it's great to know someone as awesome and talented as him. You smile again. I'll also have him as a really, really close friend.
Shamir was the complete package.
I'm waiting for you to see.
He has dope music.
Music for him is part of a thread in the tapestry of developing a community.
Community is very important, not just with music, but just in general. It's very important for just us as humans.
Heartache covered in roses.
Roses by Shamir Virgo and Amir Kuro. Yeah, Shamir told me that was the second song he ever wrote. And we'll get into that and much more in a conversation with Shamir on this edition of Viewpoints, brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative. I met with Shamir at CIVL Studios in the Student Union Building of the University of the Fraser Valley's Abbotsford campus. So nice to meet you, Shamir.
Nice to meet you, too.
That was the first of three meetups I had with Shamir over the course of about a week. The second was when Shamir and guitarist Elijah Williams welcomed me to a park in Surrey to see and hear their rehearsal for an upcoming show.
You got the list. Whoa.
I know.
In our interview, Shamir speaks about how much a collective he's part of called Couch Jams Collective offers him a sense of community. I was able to visit with Shamir in Vancouver and meet about a dozen plus people affiliated with Couch Jams gathered after a performance in the Mount Pleasant area. And Shamir, you know, he took the time to one by one introduce me to each and everyone there. And although I didn't record any interviews that night, I did come away with an impression of a young man who, for as musically talented as Shamir is, he is equal parts kind, thoughtful, and generous. An opinion shared, by the way, by Shamir's former high school musical theater teacher, John Harris, and ditto those sentiments from friend and musical collaborator, Amir. All right, let's get to know Shamir Virgo. This track is apropos, as it was the first song Shamir wrote. It's 2019's Faded Love.
I think I was always, like, involved in music, like, growing up. So, like, when I was younger, I used to sing in church. We used to have like a children's choir that I would like sing at, and we would just like be doing like different arrangements of different songs, and then we would go and like perform them for like Saturday church or like just performances, like concerts that we would host. And then like in high school I did some like musical theater, and then also just kind of dabbled in music, so I've always been around it. Somewhere along the lines of like end of high school, I was like, wow, like I really love music, I really enjoy and embody like all that I want to be when I'm around music, so like why don't I like create something, you know? My teacher, Mr. Harris, he was the one that kind of like fostered that growth. He was the one that pushed me forward and was like, hey, you should continue to do this. You should continue to, you know, pursue music. You sound great. This is something that like not a lot of people are able to do or able to like even stick with or even have the drive to stick with. And if you love it so much, then you should continue to do it. Yeah.
I thought back in those days, I don't know where his future is going to take him, but I really, really hope that he pursues this gift. And he has.
Mr. Harris, if it wasn't for him, I'd say I probably wouldn't be doing this right now.
To be able to be a part, be a small little, tiny little building block in the life of a student like that is a great honor. And it gives a meaning and a purpose to how you've spent your life in a way that's incredibly gratifying. My name's John Harris. I taught Shamir at a Langley Public School. It was called the UConnect Education Center. It was actually in three different locations, but Shamir participated in two of them, I think.
This was at Lochiel UConnect, so out in Langley.
Shamir showed right from the get-go tremendous musical aptitude.
I feel I just fell in love with you like a song on the radio.
He was a dream to work with as a musical theater teacher. I find that it's very difficult to get a blend of skills where a student can act and sing well. And Shamir was, right from the beginning, the complete package.
Are you different? Feels different.
The thing that really struck me musically was that not only did he have the musical skills, he had just excellent pitch and phenomenal ability to learn music quickly.
Case in point, here's Shamir with Elijah working out Emmanuel's Need You.
I feel I need you to breathe. Yeah. I feel I need you to
This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun.
The tone in his voice was a mixture between this soothing, melodic sound with some bite if he needed it. Really unusually beautiful tonal qualities in his voice.
For me, it started out as just wanting to like do something that I enjoyed. And music being the thing that I really, really did enjoy, I was like, well, I really want to dive headfirst into this. And so I didn't really know what that looked like, you know, and like what I had to do to grow at that point. But over now, looking back over the years, because of my like love for music and wanting to like get better and know more about it, it sort of became the driving force that led me to like want to do better and want to know more and want to improve my craft and as a singer, as well as just like a musician as well, because I play guitar. And so yeah, it just really drove me to do better and want to know more. I think at that point I had just started dabbling in terms of just like songwriting, just putting things together here and there. I think I had like made my first single at that point. And then I had just shown him some of the stuff that I had done, because it's just like, you know, you were around music. Like, not a lot of people at that time in my life were musicians or really understood or cared to understand like music in general. So I was just like, okay, like this is something that I've done. Like, what do you think? What are your thoughts? You know,
one of the first songs that he showed me that he wrote was a song called Roses. The first line, just a killer line. It goes, heartache covered in roses. Like, what a perfect tension between some of the nicer parts of love and the inevitable challenges of love. You know, like he in a couple of words, he paints a picture that, like a paradoxical cognitive dissonance that, you know, like what a way to start a song. And then, boom, you're hooked. You're drawn right in.
Good friend of mine, Amir Koro, he also makes music as well. He was the one that actually, like, put all of the or most of the instrumentation together in terms of like the arrangement. I was just looking for people to work with in terms of like musicality, because at that point I didn't know anybody around me really who did music or knew about music. And so I was just asking around, and one of my friends Jay, who I had played with at church, he had connected me to Amir. He was like, yeah, like my friend Amir, he also makes music, like you guys should connect.
What's really interesting actually is that Shamir and I have mutual friends through church. So the same friends that I grew up playing with at church are also the ones that he knows.
I shot him a message.
He first sent me an Instagram DM.
And like asked if he would be free to, I guess, meet up and like talk about, you know, our musical experiences, and he responded.
And so it was a really, really natural connection.
Kind of started from there and just continued to talk, and then
he asked, hey, do you want to get together and perhaps work on some music? And so I said, yeah, absolutely, would love to.
That led down the road of being able to like jam and just sing with him. And
given that we were both, you know, at that time in the same, you know, kind of in the same communities, kind of like going to the same things, listening to the same music, it just felt very natural to infuse that into our own styles.
Yeah, that's how it started.
He was a really, really nice guy, so it was a no-brainer to me, you know, to go and collaborate together and have fun. The first day we met, we ended up just writing Roses.
Yeah, we kind of like built off of it.
I don't know, it just came out naturally.
And then we're writing the song back and forth, had it on a loop.
When it came time to write the chords for Roses, I was still studying actually at Capilano, and I was at Capilano's jazz program. And I was like, you know what? Let's apply some of the jazz harmony that we're learning. Let's put it on a song. And, you know, after a few more writing sessions, we had a finished song between the two of us, and it came up fairly easily. He also takes initiative really well. If there's something that he wants to get done and he's like, I'll write the verse and get back to you, he will do it. The entire second verse of Roses was written entirely by him. After our first session, I was like, oh, we're missing a second verse. And he said, sure, I'll write it. And so then he just came back to me the next week and then said, all right, done. And I was like, this is great.
And then after the song was finished, we went and outsourced like different musicians that would be able to uplift the track and uplift the song better than we knew how to.
And the rest is history.
Today, between Spotify and SoundCloud plays, Roses has been listened to somewhere around 1.7 million times. And back at the park rehearsal, the song has continued to take on a life of its own.
I got sick of the sorrow, but I want to see you tomorrow.
With Shamir, we kind of go back and forth with this song since the last show even.
Yeah.
And it's been one of those fun spots for us. For sure.
Yeah.
But it's fun. I enjoy it. But yeah. Yeah. Keeps me going.
It's a spicy one.
That's okay. It all sounded nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was good.
Keep it simple, keep it clean. Yes, yeah, what you said.
I'm Elijah. I'm the guitarist accompanying Shamir.
We locking in.
Yeah. How did it feel?
Good.
Yeah. Anything that you're like.
Later on, if we have time, we can kind of run through it again.
After?
Cool. I can clear
it up. It's Shamir Virgo, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
Real. Okay, cool. We're more than halfway through already. Can you believe that? You're doing pretty well for time.
His likability was infectious. Everybody loved him, and he was there's an authenticity, a transparency, an intelligence, and this one's really important. He tunes in to other people, and he will immediately establish strong empathetic bonds. He can get right inside your soul. He was just a part of everybody's heart, you know, like everybody's heart just opened to him.
Shamir is incredibly easy to work with. He is so thoughtful, and he is so sweet, and he is so generous, and I think the things that make him a great friend are also what make him a great collaborator, because he's also not afraid to be like just fully honest and say, that wasn't, I'm not feeling that. Yeah, no, let's not do that. He is great to work with, and he can also hold his own solo.
Shout out to me. You know, yeah. It was a great experience working with him. He's a very, very, very talented and accomplished musician as well as artist, yeah.
Hopefully I'll see him next spring or summer. We'll see if we can cook up some music together. And but most importantly, just have a good time. I haven't seen him in 2 years, so that's long overdue.
He's going to school in Berkeley now, so he's pursuing his own path musically, which is great. Love that for him.
I'm literally at Berkeley right now, actually.
Mir, love you very much. I miss you. We'll connect soon. We'll connect very, very soon.
Shamir would submit those first two tracks of his, Faded Love and Roses, to the CIVL Radio presented Fraser Valley Music Awards in 2020, winning the award for excellence by a BIMPOC artist, that's Black, Indigenous, Mixed Race, or Person of Color.
Thank you so much to everybody that's been able to support me in my music, and just be there to support me as a person of color. I just really appreciate receiving this award, and it really means a lot that I've come so far in the little time that I've been making music.
Shamir would go on to win first runner-up in the Dakota Leslie fan vote in that same awards broadcast, and station manager Aaron Levy gave him a call.
Yeah, we're giving you $2,100. Shamir, do you have any plans of what you're going to do with this money?
Oh my, I think I'm just going to reinvest it and keep on working, keep on doing the same thing I've been doing, and just continue my journey of music. This is just really crazy. Oh my.
Through that, I was able to meet a lot of really great people and then gain more opportunities that way. It's been through connections through like Civil or like the UFE campus. It's been opportunities like that, just meeting people and being on campus.
And while Shamir is sure to continue creating memories on campus at UFV while he completes a Bachelor of Arts majoring in communications, his quest to build his career often leads him to Vancouver.
That's where most of the opportunities are, you know, and that's just like how it is. And it's like you have to get up and go where the money is, essentially, if that's like what you are doing to like make a living. A lot of the people I am working with and or collaborating with now, I met through the collective I'm also a part of and work with, Couch Jams Collective. And I had met the founder of Couch Jams, Matthew Yang. We actually met through Amir. So Amir and Matt, I believe, went to school together at Capilano University, and then I guess we had started talking from there and then just continued to be in touch. It started out as literally like an open mic or like a jam at Matt's house, and then through that we built Couch Jams into like a collective where people can come together and collaborate and grow and just, you know, experience just different art by other people that look like us. Our open mic series operates out of the Vancouver Black Library, so out in Chinatown at the Sunwa Center. Every month we usually host a open mic, and so BIPOC people can come, put their name down, and sign up to perform, and then they're also accompanied by musicians who also sign up to come play for them, and it's a great space to be able to like show your art to a group of people who you might not know for the first time. We use our platform to be able to promote and uplift queer and BIPOC artists out in the city, so giving them like a space to be able to like perform, but not only like just perform their music, but then give them an arrangement and then pay all the musicians for their work. Because I feel like the music scene in Vancouver especially is very like lacking, so there's not a lot of community, there's not a lot of places that you can go to connect with musicians and artists and creatives that also indulge in the same type of work that we do.
And just trying to reduce all of these memories I have of all of the musicals we did into, you know, kind of a short summation to, you know, capture the essence of this wonderful young man. Music for him is more than a craft. It's more than just doing, excelling at performing. It's more than just writing good songs. Music for him is just a thread, part of a thread in the tapestry of developing a community.
It's become like a very integral thing for me because I really stand behind community, and I really love that Couch Jams is able to offer that to so many people.
The music's important, but it's not the main thing. It's a thread that will tie together a community of people that enjoy each other and bond with each other. That's what it is. That captures what he's all about.
Community is very important, not just with music, but just in general. It's very important for just us as humans. And I feel like a lot of people want community in Vancouver, but that's something that we don't have a lot of here, you know? And so I think it's very important because community is literally like, if you have a community around you, if you're going through a tough time, you're able to lean on that community for support in those times that you might not be able to do things like on your own. And it's very important for you to be able to like have people to like maybe bounce ideas off of. Yeah, that's what I think. It's very important to have community. That's why we started Couch Jams, because we want to be able to bring all the BIPOC people together so that we can like experience and be a part of a community that didn't exist until, you know. Me being from here, I feel like it hasn't separated me from like my culture, but I feel like it's distanced my closeness to it. So like I got family. My family's from Jamaica. I was born here, so I'm Jamaican originally. But I haven't spent very much time there. So in terms of like my music and like that whole aspect, they're really known for like their reggae music, Bob Marley, the Wailers, all of those, you know, that different style of music. None of my music sounds like that. And it's interesting because I feel like also in growing up here and not having like a bunch of, like I have family here, but in terms of just like musicality and being around like that genre of music, I'm very like distanced from it. I would love to experience it more, but in terms of just like my accessibility to that, it's been very limited, you know? So I think in terms of like my experience in that and my identity as an artist, it's almost been like, it's been very internalized. And so like a lot of the things that I feel in terms of like my music and how I should sound, it's not only like the outside, but a lot of how I feel towards myself, like, oh, should I be indulging in this type of music because this is who I am? But then also it's like, if I didn't grow up around it, you know, what am I supposed to do, you know? So it's not like I can just, you know, go and, you know, do it now that I know like this is who I am. It's just a little bit, it's more deeper than that. With my skin being such like the first thing people see, it's important for me to know what gravity and what effect that I might have on people when they see and hear me. And so just being able to understand like that aspect, as well as also like what other people that look like me have done. But I also think that it's important to also realize that people are people, and that just because I am a black artist doesn't mean that I make a certain type of music or sound a certain type of way, despite what is shown through social media in terms of just how artists now are marketed to be, especially people who look like me.
Shamir insists that his love, his passion for music is the primary driving force motivating him, not dreams of fame and fortune.
Honestly, I think that's the issue. I think a lot of artists like want to be big, and that's why they want to be artists. I think for me, like I genuinely just really love I have a really great big love for music. Like, I just, even if I'm not being paid for it, I'm not saying I don't want to be paid for it, but even if I'm not paid for like what I am able to create, like I think the grounding thing for me with like sharing my music, my thing is that like as long as I'm able to touch something in the person hearing my songs, I am happy. I'm sold. That's all I need to feel, you know, blessed.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm in a much better place than I was like earlier this year, for sure. I actually had like a bit of a like a car accident. There's a lot that I feel like could have gone wrong, and the fact that I'm here to be able to speak my truth is a testament to how blessed I am.
Let's have another sample of Shamir's music. Here's part of his latest single, I Don't Need You. Waiting.
Why couldn't I leave it behind, staying? That was the last song I was able to work on with Amir before he left to go to Berkeley.
I produced that song in collaboration with another really great producer, Gabe Yaron.
We had finished it a couple years ago.
It's representative of a certain period in time for the two of us.
We were both like going through some things at that point.
I'm very proud of what we were able to make.
Very proud, very happy to be able to point people to it when they ask about my music. I don't need you
anymore. He gets it.
There are some individuals that are destined to make the world a better place, and he's one of them.
Who he appears as in his songs is exactly who he is as a person. And I just can't wait for the rest of the world to get to know that.
For Viewpoints and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Mike McCullough.
So thanks so much to Mike McCullough and his many guests for filling in for us this week. A great documentary again. Thanks to all our journalists who took over the show for me over the past weeks with original and beautiful documentaries. Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec. And to our BC journalists, Pamela Hassan and Smithers, as well as Mike McCullough in Abbotsford. Please come back anytime. To our national editors who help coordinate production, Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Merci. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. If you want to get in touch with us, please write. Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. Okay, that's it for us this week. And until the next, ciao. You hurt me twice, and I'm on my last excuse. This episode is a rerun. Though it's crazy, maybe it's not your intention. But what if maybe, maybe the problem is you? And I say, I don't need you anymore. I don't need you. No, 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 no. All out of patience, I'm all out of love to give you now. I don't need you, I don't need you anymore. I said waiting. Not anymore, foot out the door, I'm saying I ran out of room for you. Cause every time you hold me once, you hurt me twice, and I made my last excuse. And though it's crazy, maybe it's not your intention. But no more maybes, I know the problem is you. And I say that I don't need you anymore. So I don't need you. No, 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 no. All out of patience, I'm all out of love to give you now. I don't need you, I don't need you anymore.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Going down and set it straight. When all is said and done, it ain't about you. Thought you were my missing piece, but the picture's already complete without you. Without. And I say, so I don't need you. I don't need you anymore. I don't need you.
don't need you, I don't need you anymore. I don't need you, I don't need you anymore.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Plugged in My Ears. We took a little hiatus over the Christmas break, or the holiday break, I should say, perhaps. But we're back now. As per usual, I'm Sam. I'm joined by Adam and Kyle. There's so much to talk about. We've been speaking about it at length before this podcast. I'm not really sure where to begin, although I think it would be fitting to begin with the World Juniors. Kyle and I were fortunate enough to watch quite a bit of it while we were in Ottawa. Adam watched a lot at home. I think it's fair to say that we were all a little bit disappointed by Canada's performance. But I'll pass the talking shell, the conch shell, to everyone else here. Adam, Kyle, do you want to take the lead on this?
Sam just called me poor without calling me poor.
No, you just don't live in Ottawa. You don't live in Ottawa.
I'm just joking. Oh, man. But yeah, so Canada decided to skip the tournament this year, which was probably for the best, honestly, because they got embarrassed, would have gotten embarrassed if they actually played a game. Or did they actually play a game? Did they play in this tournament?
Yeah, believe it or not, they had the lowest shooting percentage of any team in World Juniors history.
Wait, this was a tournament with Kazakhstan and Latvia, right?
Yep.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yep.
Wow. Who'd have thunk?
National embarrassment.
Man. So what happened? What do you think happened? Like, I know, like, we watched the first game. They beat up on Finland, and they had a good goaltending performance. I think that was one of the highlights of the tournament. Probably the only highlight of the tournament was the goaltending for Canada. Carter George played great in net, and Jack Ivankovic played one game too, and he played well as well, even though it was a loss, but he did shut the door when he did play. So what went wrong? Where do you want to start? Like, do you want to start at the top? I know a lot of people have been blaming, like, management, the guys that picked the team, a lot of hate against Dave Cameron, the coach. Personally, I think it's the players. I know, like, it, a lot of the media has been saying not to blame these kids because they are kids and they're heartbroken over this, but I think that they've got to take the brunt of the responsibility on this, as they are the ones out there playing. I know sometimes you don't get to choose who you're playing with. So maybe that's an argument that can be made, but I was very disappointed with the discipline and the attitude of this Canada team.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I actually talked to some people over the break about this. Like a recent trend that's happened in the NHL, and I think it's kind of been, they tried to mirror this in the selection of the Canada team, was that in the NHL, like, you used to just draft the best player. Like, it wasn't even like, oh, we need a defenseman. Like, they just drafted whoever they thought was best and then kind of figured it out after. But that's not how the NHL works anymore, right? Now you actually, like, look for pieces that you want on your team, and you'll draft those depending on what you need, right? So you can have, like, players that aren't necessarily the number five player in the world, but they're getting drafted fifth, right? So it changes that. I feel like Team Canada tried to overthink this team in the sense of, like, trying to obsess over chemistry and kind of irrelevant things like, did people play in the same league, which just doesn't really matter when the team only practices for 2 weeks before this tournament. So I don't know if chemistry is going to be the main factor here, but I think the issue is, yeah, they tried to overthink this team in the sense of they drafted people from the Prairies, a ton of people from the Prairies, and they tried to make this team that was supposedly more cohesive because they play in the same league or on the same teams. That is never how Team Canada has worked in the past. It has literally just been a compilation of the top, you know, 20 or so players in the world, in the country, and you just put them on a team. They're not really practicing together. They'll figure it out. And the biggest problem I also have with this is that the idea that you have, like, pieces that you can, like, fit into a team of, like, 16 to 18 year olds. Are you telling me that someone at 16 years old has solidified themselves as, like, a specific position or role on the power play? No way.
The guy hasn't even finished his career in the OHL. Like, that's insane, the idea that this guy's going to be, like, taking, like, a specific role on the power play, because that's just what you think. Like, that's just not how it works. And that's what ended up happening. They had all these guys that were, like, chosen to be specific positions. Turns out they might not be the best one for that position, and it didn't work out. Our power play was not good. PK was not great, just because we had players that were probably not even the best player we could have had for those positions. So I think it was just an over-engineered team that, yeah, just didn't fulfill expectations. I think if they just go back to the old model of literally just looking at the stats and just drafting irrespective of other things, who do you think are the top 20 players, work from there? I mean, the other option is actually just training a team year-round. Like, if you actually wanted to win, if Canada had a team that was selected for and trained year-round, and like they like moved in and out pieces and made the best team possible, I think they would win by a landslide every year. It wouldn't even be close, right? It wouldn't even be fun. But when you just like make a team overnight and then it kind of expects it to work out, so I'm not surprised. Like, I'm not really surprised that it didn't go well. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think it's just overthought and just doesn't go well when you try to do something like that.
Well, I agree with pretty much everything you said, but I refuse to, I just don't think it's a good idea to adopt the American way of doing things. The USNDTP essentially just takes kids at the age of 17, makes them move away, train together. And by that time, anyways, they find out, oh, wait, there's actually just better kids who developed on their own. I think it would be a really big mistake to take a bunch of really good guys away from their OHL, QMJHL, WHL teams for a year and then make them train, because a lot can happen. I think actually it's a testament to Canadian excellence that six guys who could have played in the World Junior teams were not allowed to go back, and that the NHL told them to stay and play with their teams. So I think that the way Canada does their development is good, but I think Canada messed up in a few ways. And honestly, a lot of it I actually blame kind of Scott Salmon for. He is the senior vice president of hockey operations and high performance for Canada. And he's in charge of scouting. He's in charge of hiring coaching. He makes the final call on all the players that make the team. Like, it's him. So if we want to really point fingers, he made the puzzle. He just didn't make sure all the pieces fit together before he glued it. And that's kind of a big problem. Another thing too, though, is I actually know Dave Cameron because I talked to him quite a bit when I was with the 67s for like the 48 hours I was at the training camp. And not that I got to know the guy that well, but I will say he thinks at a really fast level, but I think he really missed the ball in some plays. Like, if you got a guy like Easton Cowan who's taking a dirty penalty and costs you a game, I'm sorry, that guy just doesn't get back out on the first line or the second or the third line the next game. You start right back at the bottom in a tournament like this.
Yeah.
I think we really tried to stick to guys who we thought were good. And I think because we thought they were good, they afforded themselves a degree of arrogance. And quite frankly, like, they were the Jedi and the Sith took over. You know, like, they were blinded by their own arrogance. But it's true, though. I mean, Canada thought we were on top of the world. We won 2 years in a row. We lost to the Americans last year. We thought for sure it would be an easy comeback. We have one of the better teams in the tournament, statistically speaking. I mean, we have 10 first-round picks on that team. Schaefer's probably going to be first overall if it's not Gavin McKenna in the coming draft. Like, there's a lot of really good moving pieces to this. We allowed ourselves to believe that that alone could get us through this tournament. And also, the CHL is just a tougher, dirtier league than the IIHF. And the IIHF, you're not allowed to get as close as touching someone. You give them like a little love tap, that's a, you know, it's a game misconduct. It's a suspension, a love tap. And they didn't expect that. We played Canadian hockey in a European style of game. You can't win like that.
You can't.
You cannot play Canadian hockey in European hockey.
No.
Or at least with European reffing.
I think it also goes back to what I was saying about like them trying to have all these like guys that were fit into pieces, like Easton Cowan. Like, they coached this team as if it was like the Toronto Maple Leafs, where you have like Austin Matthews. Like, Austin Matthews is set on, you know, PP1, and he's set on all these things. Like, that's not how World Juniors is supposed to work. Someone plays bad, that's okay. You just mix everything up. Like, you just switch things the next game. But they kind of refused to do that, right? Like, they had all these guys that were supposedly locked in to positions. And yeah, that's just a recipe for disaster when these guys are literally still figuring out how to play pro hockey. Yeah. So, yeah.
Totally. One thing, too, that we should probably talk about is just the American team. I mean, I was fortunate enough to watch them. I was impressed with how fast they actually were. Specifically Ryan Leonard, I don't think I've ever seen a kid skate as fast as that at that age. Granted, I haven't watched guys like McDavid play and all that when they were that young, but of all the games I went to go see, I saw some of the better teams in the tournament. Ryan Leonard was so unbelievably fast, and I think the United States beat a lot of teams because of how fast they were moving. I'm not sure if that was super noticeable on TV as well, because I didn't really watch that many of the American games other than the game against Canada. But when they played Czechia in the semifinals, the Czech guys were good, clearly. I mean, obviously they're good, they're there. But they were definitely bigger. The Americans had a much smaller team, but when I say they were literally two times faster, I can't make this up. the puck zipped around nearly as fast as the player skated. Usually it's the inverse.
Yeah. And I will say, though, one thing I did notice, I would say Czechia was probably the slowest team in the tournament.
Like, or Slovakia. Czechia or Slovakia.
Yeah. Like,
Kazakhstan, I thought it was slow.
Okay, yeah.
But the Czech guys were big. They were big. Like, their team height average must have been a good couple inches.
Above yeah, the it was probably teams. At least 6'2 or 6'3.
Their defensive, like, lineups, like, I'm not kidding, they must have all been, like, 6'4, 6'5. So they had big guys. So they were a bit slower. Sweden was really fast. And how I know this actually is because at the games, they had like this interesting stat line where they tracked players' speeds and they'd put like a leaderboard in between periods of like who was like top speeds of players and like how fast everyone was going and like the average distance traveled and stuff. And Sweden was fast. Like I think their top guy, I can't remember, or not even top player, but one of their players, like top speed was like 36.5 kilometers an hour or something. Like,
yeah, that was the defense, the captain, number four. He's really good too. He also led the tournament scoring in the round robin.
Yeah. So I think all the teams are fast. I think you're right that the States were like particularly fast.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a big difference between like speedy players and players that are fast with the puck though. Mm-hmm. I think because almost all the players can be pretty fast if they're like skating with the puck, but just like, you know, like McDavid does, obviously, like, not everyone can skate that fast with the puck on their stick, right? So the States definitely moved a lot faster with the puck on their stick, for sure.
And I'll just one side quickly, too. I just want to bring this up because, you know, a lot of people are calling for a Canadian reset with Hockey Canada. And just take this into consideration. Like, at least this is what the NHL.com wrote. The future is promising when you consider Canada won two straight IIHF World Under-17 Championships events, the past three Hlinka Gretzky Cup tournaments in the 2024 World Under-18 Championships. So this upcoming tournament, in theory, should be a big year for Canada. Like, this is a very winning roster that's coming. And I'm not sure, what do you guys think really needs to change for us to win? Because obviously we can say take less penalties, make better coaching decisions, but there's got to be something else that's structural, don't you think?
I actually disagree. I think the problem was the structuring. I think they just need to either they're going to go all in and just take it really seriously, or just keep it how it used to be. Like, we just draft the best players, because you can't do both at the same time, like not take it seriously and then suddenly, like, you know, try to increase the seriousness of the team in sense of like, yeah, having like this really thoroughly thought out draft that's just like overcomplicated. I mean, yeah, the only way to make it more structured, in my opinion, would be having a longer process of like building the team, but I don't think they're going to do that.
Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Kyle. I think that the loss to Czechia 2 years ago was kind of more of a fluky loss and everything, so they decided to adopt this kind of different strategy of team building, and I agree that it didn't work, and I think that they just need to kind of revert back to what they were doing before. I mean, Canada won so many of these World Junior Championships. It's was surprising that they were able to like just kind of scrap that whole system and then switch to what they went with this year. I had never seen that before in like my life of watching the World Juniors, where the best players weren't out there. So yeah, I mean, also I think that maybe they could modify how they do it if they want to attempt to do this again, because the one team that I think of when I think of junior hockey, at least, is the Saginaw Spirit, because they won the Memorial Cup last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a bunch of eligible players that didn't make Team Canada, specifically Zane Parekh and Michael Misa. And I think if you're going to have Gavin McKenna, who isn't even draft eligible this year, on Team Canada, then Michael Misa, who is draft eligible this year, should be on the team as well. Because, I mean, he's just won a Memorial Cup. Zane Parekh just won a Memorial Cup. He's drafted by the Flames. I was very surprised to see that those two weren't on it. But then if they try to bring up the reason that they want to build it like a chemistry based team, then you have that ability to do it. It just kind of seems like I don't know who mentioned it, but they went with a WHL team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I swear this team was like, nothing against the WHL, but it's not as good as the OHL.
No.
Like, the OHL is better.
Let's be real. The OHL is the best of the three CHL leagues.
Yeah, of course. And I don't think that's really up for discussion. And I get it that the WHL has produced a lot of talent in past years. Mainly, I mean, Connor Bedard. And I mean, you look at Gavin McKenna now coming up. Like, he's going to be a good player. But like, depth-wise, I can't say the WHL teams are deeper than OHL teams. No. So if you're going to do this team building thing,
I think you should at least choose from the best team.
Yeah.
And I think Saginaw, it was the best team last year. And I think if you want to have a team that has experience winning something, and if you want to bring that mentality to the World Juniors, go ahead. But you probably should choose it from teams that have won something instead of kind of just who you think is the most chemistry over in the WHL. So I don't know. I was very surprised with this year. But I don't know when it comes to like the next few years, I think if the U18 teams and the U17 teams have been the best players, like there's no reason why they shouldn't be included on the World Junior team.
So. Well, no, in theory, that's a really big thing because usually the US actually wins the U17 because they have the US NDTP and those guys just go and they train the whole year. And Canada has six U17 teams.
Wow.
And Canada won like all the events they participated in for that.
Is that when they're like Canada red and Canada white?
Yeah, and Canada gold and et cetera.
Yeah.
So if they won the U18 too, yeah, you'd expect that they should do well. Although, of course, so much can change, right? But I hope it's a good future. But I think we should just take the best players. I mean, that's typically what's worked. And also, when you take the best players and you put them in a position in which they had no time together and they have to figure things out, I find that it's in those most perilous moments that they end up being the best because that's what good players do. They rise to the occasion. And we didn't really give them the opportunity to rise to the occasion. We kind of told them, this is exactly what you have to do. You're a role player. And I don't know. Canada's not a role-playing team. Canada's a team of elite ODR players who happen to play in the NHL. That's who we are.
I'll branch this conversation over to it's not directly related, but I guess it's a bit related to player development, right? So a lot of players that were in World Juniors were from D1 teams, right? And with the changes in rules for D1 teams, how do you think that's going to affect World Juniors? Because that means a lot of Canadians are probably going to be playing in the States, actually, and coming back.
Yeah, kind of. I think what's going to happen is just that the CHL is going to get drastically more competitive. Because this is what's going to happen. U Sports is experiencing this really badly. Who was it? It was Waterloo, and I think it was Trent. They lost every single major junior player they had on the U Sports team to the NCAA. But typically when a guy plays in the CHL, if in their final year, their overage year, they don't really have, you know, an ECHL, an AHL offer, they'll go play U Sports. Now instead, those guys are going to go play NCAA. So I think what's going to happen is that the CHL is going to get a lot better because no one's going to commit to go to the NCAA before going to the OHL. They'd rather go play in the CHL and get the pro-like experience and then go off somewhere to like Boston College or Harvard or Princeton if they don't end up making the NHL or the AHL or the East Coast Hockey League.
Yeah.
So for player development, one good thing is that everyone will stay in Canada. And I think it's going to attract a lot of good players to come to Canada too. Like I suspect a large rise in American players trying to come here too, which has kind of been the case. It was the case a little bit in the early 2000s. I don't know if you remember this, but most OHL teams carried four or five Americans. Mm-hmm. And then the OHL changed its regulations so that more Canadians could be on the roster. And then that's when D1 started gaining a lot of traction as well, because all those good players went there. And so the quality of play went up, you know, quite a bit. But overall, I think it's going to make scouting easier. And I think people are just going to get better overall because the CHL will be better. And the CHL is what produces all these superstar players in general, by and large. I mean, not everyone, obviously, there's outliers. So I think that's going to be the most significant thing. But one other like super random thing, and sorry, not to deviate from the conversation, but there's guys in the BCHL and the USHL who have D1 offers, but they're not eligible to go yet. And so they're trying to transfer to go play on CHL teams. The average CHL transfer right now is $100,000 from a junior A team. That's like the kids have to pay $100,000.
Yeah, that's pretty.
Sorry, that's kind of irrelevant. But yeah, Adam, what do you think about that NCAA change?
Yeah, I think it's a great change. And I know the OHL is taking additional steps because they do want to expand the league into the States even more than it already is. So the American players don't even have to come to Canada in some cases.
True.
They'll be able to stay some.
Did you see that was chance. Blocked, eh?
Yeah, I saw the U.S. hockey block that. I think that will end up. I think it will go through eventually through negotiations because I think that it's still going to be beneficial. I think they're going to have to prove that the U.S. won't lose their hockey players. Like, I think it's the U.S. national development team that's probably.
Yeah, I don't think they're happy about this.
Yeah, they're not the ones that aren't happy about this because, well, I mean, they're a huge money maker and they like almost make all their money off of these players, like off of these kids from what, when they're 14 till.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, my buddy Josh Deal got invited at the age of 14. His parents were like, no.
Yeah.
You're 14. You're not leaving Florida to go to Minnesota or wherever it is.
Yeah. And I think that it's almost like the OHL definitely, or I mean, the CHL in general, I definitely think was exploitive of kids as well. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, they're making a profit off of these kids as
massive
well.
Profit.
And I know that the NCAA obviously is just as exploitive in a lot of cases, especially with student athletes before this NIL deal and everything. But at least the kids were getting an education when they would go over and play D1. Mm-hmm. So I think that they just need to change their strategy to make it seem more like a benefit for the states as well. Like the teams are going to bring revenue to these American cities that they're coming in. I think they really have to handpick the cities that they're going into, like cities that don't have large markets yet, but like you could develop like a smaller town or a city into like more of a, I don't know, trying to find like an OHL, an Ontario equivalent. So like a Kingston equivalent in the states, and not targeting the larger markets. Just so like it brings more benefit to kind of hockey in the states. You know what I mean?
No, I do. I think it's actually easier in the QMJHL because I'm just thinking of Maine and Vermont right now. There's a ton of hockey towns there that just don't have a team. They'll drive all the way to the University of Maine or Vermont to watch a D1 game. Just put an QMJHL team right there. It's super close to the border. I mean, people forget this. Sherbrooke is closer to the border than Ottawa is. And Sherbrooke has a QMJHL team. Like, that's not bad. That's saving money for the Q. And if you can, I mean, if God bless Newfoundland, they just got a QMJHL team, but it's kind of out of the way. I mean, I'm sure those guys are going to relocate in 4 or 5 years, just like the Fog Devils did all those years ago, too.
Yeah.
But if they can centralize stuff a little bit more, it's just going to save money and make money.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it definitely shook things up a lot. I mean, as you said, Sam, like the U Sports is
they're screwed.
A very different landscape than it was last year. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it'll be even more disrupted this coming year, especially, right?
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's hard to say what's going to happen in Queens. I don't actually know what's going on, but it's going to change in some ways. Like, I'll say this. There are, I think, 61 D1 hockey schools. Mm-hmm. 10 are really good right now. I expect another 10 schools to drop a lot more money on their hockey programs because of this. That's about it. I really don't think that... I don't think schools like Robert Morris University and Kansas College are going to spend $100 million extra a year to attract guys from the CHL. So I do think that's going to have an impact on U Sports, but I also think a lot of guys who are fringe OHL, QW players are not going to want to opt in for, going to a bad school like Merrimack or something like that. Like, I think that's, they're going to prefer to go to U Sports, but like most U Sports teams are 80% major junior. I think it's going to drop to more like 10 in the coming years.
Well, another thing I actually will say, I think this might make the NCAA hockey more physical. Because, hopefully. Well, no, I think it will for sure. Because Canadian hockey is quite a bit different than American hockey in the sense there's way more physicality, especially the CJHL. Mm-hmm. So I think if we're sending players over to play D1 there, it's going to shake up how that league operates a little bit. Because they definitely have, like, I wouldn't say smaller players on average, but I don't know.
The Americans are smaller.
It's just because of the way they play. Like, they're not selecting for having big defensive lineups that are crushing or pounding the other team into oblivion or like. You know what I mean, it's more about like skilled hockey.
Yeah, there's no dumping and chasing.
But if you've got really good players coming from the OHL, I think it'll switch up how the game is played a little bit. NCAA there.
Mm-hmm. Before we start this podcast, I know Adam wanted to talk about the Montreal Canadiens. We should probably do an NHL update because there's been a lot going on in general.
Mm-hmm.
But Adam, I'll let you take the charge.
Well, I don't want to talk about it right now because they're losing 3-1 to Vancouver right now. They just gave up 2 goals in 20 seconds. That's got to be a record. But they've been hot recently, and they seem to only beat good teams. Mm-hmm. They beat Tampa, Florida, Vegas, and Colorado, so your last 4 Stanley Cup champions. They came back in 2 of those games. They came back against Vegas and they came back against Tampa Bay. So definitely, and they did it all on the road as well. So, I mean, this is a team that's fighting. They did lose to Chicago and Columbus, which was awkward to say the least, especially since those games were in between these great wins. But they're a point out of a playoff spot right now. And if they can maybe get a comeback here against Vancouver, they would jump into a playoff spot, replacing your Ottawa Senators. Which would be a little awkward on the show, but but yeah, I know. I think it's been a great rebuild season. I personally am not expecting them to make the playoffs this year. I don't think that they really have the talent to, and I think at the trade deadline they're still going to be making some moves. So I don't know how that chemistry will go into the later end of the season. But I don't know, I like what I see. It's promising to see this team be able to come back against such good teams that are still good now too. So yeah,
I think they're going to have I think they're going to end up having the best defensive core in the league in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah,
they have some insane D-man right now. I can't see a situation in which Mayu
and Hudson don't end up becoming like top 10 D in the league.
I think Hudson is a unicorn the way he plays. I know like you can make fun of his head fakes and everything, but I've never seen a Montreal Canadiens defenseman skate with the puck the way that he skates with the puck. Even a forward, honestly. Like the way that he can control, like he almost makes the defense look like they're standing still.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the best on defense, which I know is like
that's his biggest criticism too.
But I mean if he's gonna be like he leads the team in assists, so I mean like I don't care. If you can do that, then it's kind of the same with Patrick Laine. Mm-hmm. He's gonna be a liability on defense, but if he's scoring on like 45% of the power plays, then like whatever. Go and stand in your spot and take slap shots all day. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like that's something that I've seen from this Montreal team is that they're all kind of buying into the system now. Yeah. So I think that's exciting. They got Demidov coming next year. He'll be a rookie. That's exciting. He's tearing up the KHL and he's on a minute limit because the KHL knows he's leaving to go play in the NHL next year. And they don't want him like becoming like a fan favorite or a star player on the team that he's on. It happens a lot with actually a lot of Russian prospects. They limit the minutes just so they aren't getting as many opportunities to like score or be like a high point player because of their leaving. Huh. And he is still top three on the team in points and top 10 in the league in points as a rookie. And he just scored insane goal last couple nights ago.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah, no, he's been great. But yeah, Montreal is looking good. They got Dobesh. They decided to stop Caden Primo, which I love because Primo was not playing very well. He was like statistically the worst goalie in the NHL this year. So they brought up Jakub Dobesh, who was playing in Laval. Allowed one goal in his first two NHL games, shut out the Florida Panthers, and allowed one goal to Colorado. So pretty good start to a career for him. But yeah, Sam, I mean, the Ottawa Senators, they're doing pretty good too. So what do you got to say about them? I mean, I feel like both of our teams, this is like probably the first time in the podcast that both of our teams are fighting for a playoff spot at the midway point of the season.
I know. What a turbulent series of events and time we've gone through together. I think since we've been at Queens, both these teams have been pretty horrendous, horrific at best. Yeah. But, you know, this is a bit of a serendipitous situation here. We're falling on some good chance. So maybe there'll be some serenity at the end of the season for us all. But I don't know. I mean, hey, look, Ottawa's doing okay, but they also just got blown up by St. Louis the other day for nothing. And that was a really embarrassing game. Like everything I thought that was going well for Ottawa all of a sudden went to absolute chaos.
Yeah. I mean, Ottawa has had a bit of a bad spot. Well, actually, we'll also say the Panthers had a really weird couple weeks back there where they had, I think they got shut out four times in the span of like 3 weeks or something. Like it was ridiculous. I couldn't believe that was real. One of them was against Montreal, but they got shut out four times. I don't think I've ever heard of that before, especially with a team that has like a bunch of big high scoring forwards like Sam Reinhart and stuff. So yeah, that was kind of odd. The Panthers are not totally out of the race or anything like that, but yeah, definitely a weird spell for those guys. Ottawa, yeah, they're kind of in a bit of a rut. I will also blame it a tiny bit on the road schedule. Like Ottawa tends to get poor road schedules.
This one's because of the World Juniors.
Yeah, again, World Juniors last year it was because we had those Europe games, but yeah, not a great road trip, and yeah, you can't expect to win all those games, but yeah, it's unfortunate we've come out with quite a few losses from those ones.
But I still think there's hope at the end of the line. But I will say, if Ottawa doesn't win this year or like make the playoffs this year, and if they don't make it next, I don't know what this rebuild is for. We just wasted a lot of time and a lot of money. Ottawa's prospects.
I will say Ottawa's in a very different boat than Montreal. Montreal's got comparable level points right now in this season to Ottawa, and Ottawa is like out of a rebuild somehow. Mm. Montreal is in the midst of one, and they seem to be about the same level of skill. So that tells you plenty about the Ottawa Senators. I think we had one or two prospects in the World Juniors that were Sens prospects. One of them was on Sweden.
Was it the Kazakhstani goalie? blown up.
I think a prospect was like one of the fourth liners on Sweden or something. So some pretty low level prospects, nothing huge. But yeah, not a lot of depth in the prospect pool for Ottawa for sure.
So, you know what's funny? Sorry, just an anecdote about the World Juniors. But Kazakhstan, after the first two games, started subbing out their goalies halfway through so that their goals against average wasn't above 10.
Smart move. I like that.
Yeah. But anyways, thank you so much for joining us all this week on
Love Podcasts. Want to try your hand at podcasting? Why not make your mark and join CFRC's podcast network?
Visit podcast.cfrc.ca. Check out the great podcasts already produced right here at CFRC and find out how you too can have your very own podcast.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
What's going on? 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 What's going on?